We are, as you know, in the midst of the Reformation Church. So we are looking at a very short window of time, interestingly enough, just a period of time from around the beginning of the 16th century to the mid part of the 16th century, just about 50 years. We have spent a number of weeks in that 50 years looking at the theological epiphany of Luther and how his ideas of justification by faith began to grow out into a reformation and spread throughout Central Europe. We looked at the appearance simultaneously of another man in Switzerland by the name of Zwingli, who also came to an understanding of these doctrines at virtually the same time. Then in the midst of doing that, his taking on reforming activities in Switzerland. We looked at the rise of the radical reformers, the Anabaptists who rose and spoke, in a sense, along with Luther and Zwingli, but pushing the envelope even further, demanding even more reformation than what these men had been suggesting. And then over the last couple of weeks, we've looked at the life and legacy of John Calvin and his importance to the Reformation, his importance to continuing that as what many call a second-generation reformer. The movement of Lutheranism and Protestantism from Central Europe into Western Europe over that period of 50 years. A great movement of the Spirit of God throughout the church and throughout Western and Central Europe during this period of only about 50 years. Again, contrast that to 1,400 years prior to that, that the church had been around, that the Lord did all of this in just this very short window of time. So, as we continue our examination of the Reformation Church, then we're going to have to decide what our next steps are. Because here's the problem. We have so much that we could talk about from this point forward. It's almost impossible to really figure out even where to navigate. There's massive kinds of things we could be talking about. So we're going to need to narrow that down a little bit to get to a place of some reasonableness, because otherwise we'll be talking about the Reformation Church until the Lord returns. So we're going to shrink that a bit. There's a lot of parts of the Reformation that occurred in Europe that we could talk about. We could talk about how it moved into Spain. We could talk about how it moved into the Low Countries. We could talk about how it even moved to the East. We could talk about so many different players and so many different things that there's just too much. So what we need to do, I think, is focus our attention on the specific line of the Reformation that moves towards us. Okay? I think that would be the best way to approach this. There's a lot of Reformation, or a lot of the consequences of the Reformation, that are not really directly involving us, but there's a line that will, and I think that's the direction we ought to go. Not that those other things aren't important, extremely important. I mean, literally billions of people are affected by all the rest of the Reformation, but it's simply too much to deal with, and I don't want to pile so much detail on you that you eventually lose interest. The goal is to fix where we're at. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to now pick up from about the middle part of the 16th century, and we're going to move forward through the 17th century and even a bit into the early 18th century, okay? As we talk about the Reformation Church, because at some point we'll have to break and talk about the modern church, because it's kind of hard to figure out where one begins and the other ends. But we're gonna move chronologically from into the second half of the 16th century and beyond. So to do that, we're gonna move to the Reformation in England. Okay, the Reformation spread out of Central Europe west to Europe and Scotland, I mean to England and Scotland. So we're going to move in that direction. So we're going to talk about the early Reformation in England, and then we're going to talk about the later Puritan Reformation that also occurred in England. Okay? Then we're going to talk about the Catholic Counter-Reformation and the Council of Trent, which is important for us to talk about, because we need to understand, okay, how did the Catholic Church respond to the Reformation? That is, take it lying down, okay? Then we need to talk about the rise of other kinds of thinking that arose in these days. One would be, of course, the rise of Arminianism over against Calvinism. But we also need to talk about the rise of rationalism and empiricism and deism, which are all fundamentally going to come out of the Enlightenment. And that's going to have a strong impact upon where the church is going to go into modernity. And then, of course, you really can't talk about the Reformation, unless, especially as it relates to us, unless you talk about the establishment of the 13 colonies here and the church that is a part of that movement flowing out of the Reformation in England. So, again, that's the track coming to us, right? So that's the direction that we're going to go. So we can't talk about every aspect of the Reformation, but we will focus on those things most relevant to us. So we're going to start with the spread of the Reformation to England, and we're going to skip over the Reformation moving to Scotland, Spain, and other parts of Europe. Now, to talk about the English Reformation, I guess you could call it the English-speaking Reformation, would probably be the better way to say it. We're going to talk about it in two parts, as I said. We're going to talk first about the early Reformation that came to England, and this occurred during the first half of the 16th century, and then we'll move into the second half of the 16th century and beyond when we talk about the Puritan Reformation that followed it later. Okay, so to understand the English Reformation fully, what I'm going to do is bring together two disparate time frames, two time periods across two lectures back to back. Okay, so I'm going to talk tonight about the early Reformation in England, and then when I come back 2 weeks from now, I'm going to talk about the Puritan Reformation. Those are separated by time, but I think they fit together. In a sense, one will lead to the other, which will lead us to a complete understanding of the totality of the Reformation in England. Many chronological histories, like the one I'm working with, The Story of Christianity by Gustav Gonzalez, he separates them by a number of chapters and intervenes a whole bunch of other stuff between them, because there is a whole lot of history between the early Reformation in England and the later Puritan Reformation, particularly in Europe. But I'm going to draw them back together again, because I think it'll make more sense to us if I do that. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to have a discussion of the entire Reformation in England, even though it's broken up over time. Now, you'll notice I said 2 weeks from now, because I'm not going to be here next week. But Perry's going to come in and talk about what he thinks is a very interesting doctrine as a part of the Reformation that he wants to share some different insights on from different perspectives. And so I'm going to give him this box. We have to do a little traveling, and so we'll be away for a week, but he'll come and do that. So we'll be splitting this into two lectures across a period of time. Now, to talk about the early Reformation in England, we have to talk about four monarchs. We have to talk about four kings and queens in England. How many of you are familiar with English history? How many of you are familiar with the history of the British throne? Somewhat?
Somewhat.
Yeah. Okay. All right. What's ironic about this, and this is shocking to some people, the Reformation comes to England in the time of the most interesting monarch to ever sit on the throne of England, Henry VIII. Okay? I think it's been said by many historians that Henry VIII is probably the most interesting, the most fascinating, the most profound, even, monarch that ever sat on the English throne. We all know Henry VIII, of course, is the one who had like 100 wives and killed most of them and, you know, fathered children outside of his marital relationships and the whole nine yards. And you've probably even seen documentary series and even fictional accounts of Henry VIII's life. He's a fascinating man. He's clearly interesting. Henry VIII was born in 1491 and lived until 1547. He began his reign in 1509 and reigned until his death. So you will notice, if you'll notice these dates, 1509 to 1547 is the period of the early Reformation under Luther and Zwingli and Calvin. Is it not? The dates line up. Exactly. Henry VIII and I share a birthday, June the 28th. His was a bit earlier than mine, 1491, so he's a bit older than me. He did begin his reign on the throne at the age of 17. He came to the throne in 1509, which is just before Luther's 95 Theses tacked to the door. Remember, that was in 1517. So just before Luther had his epiphany about justification by faith, Henry VIII comes to the throne. He ruled England through the entire first half of the 16th century, thus was the king of England during the rise of Protestantism on the continent. Now, let me just pause and insert an opinion here. Do you think that's providential? Do you think it was God who ordained for this unbelievably charismatic and interesting character to be on the throne of England at the very time that a Reformation would break out in this little 50-year window of time across 1,500 years, that this guy would be the guy to be on the throne?
There are no coincidences.
Correct. The 16th century had what we today call Great Britain divided. Britain, or England itself, was ruled by the House of Tudor, and the Stuart kingdom was ruling in Scotland to the north. The relationship between the two nations at this point was one of war and enmity. It was bloody. It had been going on for centuries. The Scots had been pushing for their independence for a long time, managed to secure it in the days of William Wallace, and then later lost it again, and it's been an ongoing struggle between the two. Even today, there are rumors that Scotland wants to secede from the English monarch. Again, it's been a constant battle on that island for a very long time. England at this time was an ally of Spain. Scotland was an ally of France. All right, so they both got their power from great powers outside of themselves. Henry Tudor was the third child and second son of King Henry the Seventh. Sorry, King Henry the Seventh. Yeah, Seventh. Yeah, I was confused there for a second. His father and his mother Elizabeth of York. His elder brother was a man by the name of Arthur, who was Prince of Wales. He had one older sister by the name of Margaret and a younger sister by the name of Mary. Now that Mary is technically Mary Tudor, but will not be the Mary Tudor we'll be talking about later in this lecture. Henry was, as most children were at that time, was baptized in the church by a man by the name of Richard Fox. He was the Bishop of Exeter, a Franciscan monk who had an order near the palace, and so he was baptized as all English babies were in those days, or most English babies were. Now, to seal the relationship between England and Spain, Henry VII, Henry VIII's father, arranged for his heir, Arthur, his firstborn son, to marry Catherine of Aragon, who was a daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain. You did that sort of thing in those days. You arranged a marriage with another powerful entity in order to establish an allyship, a relationship. And so Henry VII thought, I need to marry my son to this woman in order to secure a relationship between them. But Arthur died just 4 months after the wedding. Just 4 months. So Henry VII agreed, at the suggestion of Ferdinand and Isabella, to marry their daughter, Catherine, to her deceased husband's younger brother, Arthur's younger brother, who would be Henry VIII, all right, or Henry Tudor at this particular point, his second-born son. The problem was that church law prohibited marriage of a widow to the husband's brother. Canon law prohibited that at this point. I'll explain why in a minute. So English representatives in Rome obtained a papal dispensation for the marriage to take place. In other words, the king dispatched his royal messengers to the Pope in Rome, insisting that this needed to happen, and the Pope agreed to it, granting a papal dispensation which allowed Henry to marry Catherine, or for them to be married. There was significant doubt as to whether the Pope possessed such authority, that he possessed the authority to override church canon law in order to allow this particular marriage to occur. So the legality of the marriage hung as a shadow over it from this point forward. And that becomes significant as you understand what's about to take place. Henry and Catherine were indeed married, but she never bore him a male heir that survived to adulthood. They had a number of children that died in childbirth or in very young age, but none of them survived to adulthood, and so they had no actual male heir for Henry to pass down his throne to when he would eventually ascend to it. Their only surviving adult child was Mary Tudor. Now, again, it's not the same Mary as Henry's sister, but Mary Tudor was the only surviving child of Henry VIII in adulthood. So this perplexed Henry as to what to do. So he proposed the solution that his marriage to Catherine be annulled by the church. To be annulled means that the church declares the marriage itself was non-existent, that it never actually occurred, so that he could marry another woman and father a male heir. Now, fictionalized accounts of Henry VIII's life often argue that he was already infatuated with Anne Boleyn at this time. But there's plenty of evidence to suggest that's not the case, that he was simply doing this on political grounds, not out of matters of the heart, that he was looking for a political and legal reality, not a romantic one, but nonetheless makes for interesting Hollywood, right? He argued that the marriage was illegal anyways. He went back to the original argument, by the way, that was made by those around the Pope at the original point where he married Catherine, to argue that exactly what they said was true. It was not legal for him to marry this woman because the church made it illegal. And he even argued, ironically, that the fact that he never was able to, that his wife was never able to bear him a male heir, was proof that God had a divine anger against this relationship, and thus it should be annulled. He actually makes the argument that God was displeased, and he made his argument based on Leviticus chapter 20 and verse 21, in which it specifically says in the law that a woman is not to be married to her widow's brother. But, as political intrigue would have it, Miss Catherine happened to be the aunt of King Charles V. Now, you remember King Charles V. We talked about King Charles V in here a lot because he comes up all the time in the Reformation. You remember that King Charles V was the Holy Roman Emperor. Remember? He's the guy that was ultimately elected to become the king over Germany and thus to become the king over the Holy Roman Empire in spite of what the Pope wanted. He wanted Francis I of France to become the guy, and actually one of his friends, and then if that wouldn't work out, to have Francis I. Okay, so Charles V is the guy who is quite literally in control of Central Europe and even the papacy at this point. Catherine is his aunt. So Henry VIII is married to the aunt of the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. And of course, Charles V owned the Pope and insisted that the relationship not be annulled. And of course, the Pope, caught between a rock and a hard place, decides to kind of prolong the whole thing for a long time and hope that it would go away. That didn't work. And so he refused flat out in 1527 to offer this annulment. His name was Clement VII. This refusal by the Pope to Henry began a new policy in England affected by Henry VIII, in which he attempted to break England from Rome. All right, you see why this whole story of Catherine of Aragon is so important. It isn't just the story about a man who wants a male heir or has fallen in love with his mistress and wants to divorce his wife. All of that is subtext. The real text here and how it relates to the Reformation is that Henry becomes angered with the Pope and the Roman Church and thus sets about in certain policies and puts certain policies in place in order to not only get his way in terms of his relationship with his wife, but it kicks open the door to a break with Rome. Well, if you break with Rome, guess what gets to slip in through the open door? Reformation gets to slip in through that door. The growing animosity then between Henry and the Catholic Church was the opening for Reformation. The king began putting clergy more directly under his control. Instead of allowing the clergy to be controlled by Rome, he actually started insisting that they would come under his control. And he even went so far as to threaten to withhold funds to the church from England, from the various legates in England, monies that, of course, would be important to the Pope. In fact, he even went so far as to force Rome to name his religious advisor, a man by the name of Thomas Cranmer, to become the Archbishop of Canterbury, the most significant post in England in terms of the bishopric. The Archbishop of Canterbury wielded unbelievable power in the church, and he forced the Pope to get his own personal advisor, a man by the name of Thomas Cranmer, to that particular role. Now, let me be clear about something, okay? Henry VIII was no Protestant, all right? He was never a Protestant. Henry VIII was a staunch Catholic. In fact, before this time, if you go back in time a little bit in Henry's life, the ideas of Luther had begun coming into England near the beginning of his reign. And while these ideas begin spreading in Europe, he himself, Henry VIII, the King of England, writes a treatise against Luther in 1521. He writes a specific imperial edict in regards to Luther's ideas. He specifically denied the idea of justification by faith alone that Luther was advocating, many of the other kinds of reforms that Luther was insisting upon. He was a Catholic through and through. And so when he wrote this, the Pope granted him the title Defender of the Faith. The Pope who did this was a Pope by the name of Leo the X. Remember him? Remember the guy that sent Tetzel to Wittenberg to sell indulgences in order for him to build St. Peter's Basilica? And when Tetzel came to town, Luther responded with great vigor against the indulgence seller in that place, which ultimately caused him to tack his 95 theses to the door. Okay? We're talking about an intertwined period of time here. Everybody's talking to everybody. All right? So Henry VIII is being called by Leo X, the defender of the faith, in these particular days. But his defense of papal authority in this treatise was actually rather contingent. In fact, we might say highly contingent, meaning based on certain ifs. All right? And this is important. What Henry believed was truly needed was not a reformation of the church. Oh, no. That's not what was needed. What was needed was for the church to once again be established, to be restored, so that the rights of the crown would be established against papal intervention. What did Henry want? Henry didn't want the church changed to be different than what it is in terms of its theological or even ecclesiological reality. Now, what did he want? He wanted power over the church. He wanted the church restored, and I use that word explicitly, restored to a place where it answered to the crown. Ironically, as it did in Europe, as it did all over Europe. Under whom? His wife's nephew, Charles V. Henry wasn't interested in some sort of theological debate, and there is, in my opinion, Henry was not a believer. He was not a Christian. He was a Catholic of his day. He simply was what you would be in that day, baptized Catholic. He wasn't really a defender of the church at all. He wanted the church to be modified in such a way that would grant him what he wanted. And what did he want? He wanted out of his marriage to Catherine. Now, at this point, of course, as Henry begins to push away from Rome, and begins pushing England away from Rome, Lutheran ideas are circulating in England. And those who held to them rejoiced over Henry's growing distance between himself and the Roman Church. Him pushing the Roman Church back is fueling the ideas of Reformation in England. Wycliffe's program of Reformation, you remember, 100 years earlier than Luther, had included the creation of a national church under the direction of civil authorities. Wycliffe had suggested that as a part of his Reformation. Break it away from popes and bishops and put it under civil control, which you remember is quite a bit like what you saw in Luther's day and even in Geneva in Calvin's day when the church was very much under a civil magistrate. That's why we call those guys magisterial reformers. You see. The break with Rome took place in 1534. Parliament, at the behest of Henry, enacted a series of laws forbidding payment of annates to Rome, that Henry's marriage to Catherine was null and void, and that the king was now the supreme head of the Church of England. In 1534, a new entity appeared. It's called the Church of England, with the king as its head. That church continues to exist to today in England. Those of you who watched the marriage of Princess Diana to Prince Charles, watched from Westminster Abbey that marriage being officiated by a bishop of the Church of England, a church that today is officially headed by Queen Elizabeth II. It's her church. She is the head of the Church of England. This is where it begins, 1534. Additionally, not only did Parliament do these things, but it also declared, and I'm pretty sure this is Henry's idea, that anyone who dared argue that the king was a schismatic or a heretic, meaning not the lawful head of the church, would be guilty of treason. Which is the reason that Sir Thomas More was executed for refusing to affirm the position that Henry was in fact the head of the church. It's a long, convoluted story about Sir Thomas More. If you're interested in it, I would encourage you to read it. Don't have time to put it in here. So after 24 years of marriage to Catherine, that's how long it took for him to get this done, Miss Catherine was banished, and Henry then went on to marry Anne Boleyn. I say marry in quotes because he was already married to her. They redid the marriage ceremony because the original marriage was not legal, but so they did another one, married her. And as you know, he then went on to marry a bunch of other women, Jane Seymour, Anne of Cleves, Catherine Howard, and Catherine Parr. Now, I mention that because of this. Each of these women that Henry married would have an effect upon the Reformation in England, because each of them would raise children who would affect how that Reformation would go. All right, so keep that in mind. Yeah, Henry had, what, 16 wives? But they all had a particular purpose as a part of this process. We kind of look at it like, what a goofy story. But no, there's more boiling in all of this, historically speaking. The schism, as I said before, was not an attempt at reformation. In fact, few doctrinal positions between Catholicism and Anglicanism were actually enacted. The Church of England is not technically a Reformed church. It is a hybrid between Catholicism and early forms of Protestantism. So it's not entirely true to say that if you're coming out of the Anglican world, such as an Episcopalian in America, which is the offshoot of Anglicanism in this continent, that you're necessarily part of the Reformed tradition. There are some things in Anglicanism that are broken from Rome, but there's not a lot of theological difference here. This schism was really just a legal and political reality for Henry to accomplish. Now, that doesn't mean then that those who saw Reformation as a possibility in England didn't take advantage of that schism. They really wanted to do. They saw this as an opportunity for a thorough Reformation itself. So under Henry's reign, during the rest of his days, after the church had been split, with and without his support, most of the time without, but Henry was a shrewd guy. Once in a while, when something came along that he thought would be good for himself, he would allow it to go through. Various ideas of Reformation spread throughout the nation. Thomas Cranmer, I mentioned him earlier, the Archbishop of Canterbury, he ordered that the Bible be translated into English and placed in every church where everybody could read it. So Cranmer got an English copy of the Bible, put it in every church so that everybody could read it, and this allowed for advocates of Reformation to quite literally go through the country from church to church and take people and say, let me show you from Scripture where the Catholic Church is wrong and we're right. Because now you have an actual copy of the Bible in your own language. In other words, at almost the exact time that Luther is writing or translating a copy of the Bible into German in Germany, Cranmer is having it translated in England into English at almost the same time. Henry suppressed the monasteries, and of course he did that as a part of his poking his finger in the eye of the Church of Rome, taking their monies away, especially because you remember that's where the monies were held in much of Catholicism in those days, the monasteries. And so he took their funds and lessened their power. And this then lessened the so-called conservative wing with those supporting the Catholic Church. When I say conservative, I mean going back to the way it used to be, meaning we were Catholic once and we're not that anymore. So the conservative wing began to find its power being pulled out from under it just by virtue of the policy of Henry in suppressing the monasteries. The humanists, who were numerous and powerful also in England as they were in Europe, saw in Henry's policies an opportunity to achieve a Reformation without the excesses of the German Protestants, you know, all that theological stuff about justification by faith and all that kind of stuff. Now, we can get rid of that. What we really need is a true Catholic church that doesn't have a bunch of corrupt people at the top. That's what we need to create. So they were looking to produce that kind of Reformation in England and saw this as an opportunity to do the same from that outpost. So the result of this is then, at Henry's death, the advocates of Reformation had ample support throughout England. Now again, let me just pause and point out something. At this point, the Reformation in England is extremely infantile. There's very little to it. There's not much in the way of real Reformation going on. But remember, we're talking about 1547 here. We're really getting to just about the end of Luther's life at this point when Henry VIII dies. So it's you wouldn't expect a whole great deal of Reformation to break out. But it's after Henry VIII where that snowball that started rolling during his age really gets spinning. And we come then to the next monarch, is a man by the name of Edward VI. He was born in 1537, died in 1553, came to the throne in 1547 at Henry VIII's death. Edward was the only male heir of Henry VIII, the only male heir born to Henry VIII of all the wives that he had. He was born to Jane Seymour. He came to the throne at the age of 9. He never reached maturity. You will notice that his reign ended in 1547, which implies that he died at the age of 16. He never reached manhood. He was never an adult. So his realm was governed by a regency council, which was led at first by his uncle Edward Seymour, Jane's brother. He was raised as a Protestant. The son of Henry VIII, a staunch Catholic, was raised by Jane Seymour, his mother, as a Protestant, because Jane was a Protestant. Remember I said earlier that these women had effect upon the direction the Reformation would go? They're not just throwaway people in some story about the romantic life of Henry VIII. Mm-mm. There's more going on here. Edward was raised as a Protestant due to the influence of his mother, and this furthered the causes of Reformation in England. Because his uncle, who was leading the regency at first, was also a Protestant, he was able to, through Edward, because Edward is still a child, use the position of Edward to advance certain Reformation causes in England at the time, after Henry's death. The cup in communion, meaning the cup of the table, was restored to the laity. Remember, that was one of the things that Luther and others had dealt with in the European Reformation about restoring the cup in communion, because it wasn't being offered to the laity during communion services on the continent. This guy puts it back in. Members of the clergy were allowed to marry. Again, that's a big deal in Europe. That was one of the things that Luther himself pushed for. And images were removed from the churches. Again, similar to the continent. In other words, many of the same kinds of things that were going on the continent related to Reformation were also coming to England. And this is immediately after Henry VIII's death. Thomas Cranmer, still the Archbishop of Canterbury, published at this time something called the Common Book of Prayer. It is a liturgical outline in the Anglican community. It is a English-speaking liturgy. What is the language of the liturgy of the Catholic Church? Latin. This was the first liturgy in the common language for the people. We call it the Book of Common Prayer. It replaced the Latin rites in the Anglican Church with uniquely English ones. And in later editions of that Book of Prayer, which, by the way, still exists and is used today in the Anglican Church, in later editions, the influence of Zwingli is found in that document, in that liturgy. It's highly notable, particularly in the words of the minister in regards to the offering of the bread to the communicant. The man walks to the front to receive the bread in communion, right? Also to receive the cup, but to receive the bread. The priest, if you will, the Anglican priest in this case, in the initial version of the Book of Common Prayer said this, quote, "The body of our Lord Jesus Christ, which was given to thee, preserve thy body and soul unto everlasting life." In the Catholic Church, that's simply shortened to the body of Christ. When you walk to the front, stand before a priest in the Catholic Church, he holds the host up before you, and he says, "The body of Christ," and you say, "Amen," because what you are agreeing to is that that host has been transubstantiated into the actual body of Christ. The later edition of the Book of Prayer said this, quote, "Take and eat this in remembrance that Christ died for thee, and feed on him in thy heart by faith with thanksgiving." That's a massive difference between the two. In this case, the Zwinglian influence is quite obvious. Zwingli, remember, argued with Luther about what the supper meant and how it was to be taken. Luther insisting that this was still sacramental in nature and that it was to be something that didn't necessarily infuse grace per se to salvation, but there was a salvific essence to it. Zwingli said, if you're going to be reformed, okay? You can't think of the supper that way anymore if you're going to think about justification by faith. That effect has come to England in the Common Book of Prayer. Under Edward's short reign then, just this short time, the leaders of the Reformist Party, increasingly inclined towards Reformed theology, were hopeful that their views would now become normalized in England. And what dates is Edward on the throne? He's on the throne in the life of John Calvin in Geneva. The Calvinistic thinking coming out of Geneva is finding its way across Europe and even into England, and there's Calvinistic tendencies now starting to make their way into England in the days of Edward VI, the son of Henry VIII. Which leads us to the third monarch that we have to talk about in all of this, because if you're going to talk about Reformation, the early Reformation in England, you've got to talk about a woman known as Mary Tudor. Mary Tudor, you remember, was the daughter, the only surviving adult daughter of Catherine of Aragon and Henry VIII. She was born in 1516. She died in 1558. She came to the throne in 1553. She ruled 5 years. As Edward's, you remember, Edward died at a young age, only about 16, but he knew that he was going to die. He contracted a terminal illness. So he wrote up a succession plan designed to prevent the country's return to Catholicism. He tried to name his first cousin, Jane Grey, as his heir. She did, in fact, take the throne of England after his death, but she was deposed by Mary Tudor just 9 days after taking the throne. As I said, Mary I was the only child of Henry VIII by Catherine of Aragon to survive to adulthood, but she was a staunch Catholic. And this was only exacerbated by the movement of Reformation that had begun when her father had declared his marriage to her mother illegitimate. If your father and mother's marriage are declared to be illegitimate, what does that make you? There's a word. It's illegitimate, but there's another word.
Yeah.
That was the word that was being used in England about her. She hated that. And she hated the, and she blamed her father for that. She blamed the Catholic Church. She blamed the Protestants, I should say, in England for pushing him away from Rome, pushing him away from what he wanted but could never get from Rome, which was that annulment and ultimately the declaration that the marriage was illegitimate. So she took it upon herself to remake England Catholic. She began this process by consolidating her position in England. She married her cousin, Philip of Spain, Philip II, who was in the Catholic House of Habsburg, garnering the support of her cousin, Charles V, also, of course, a Catholic, the leader of the Roman Church, the Holy Roman Empire. And a number of conservative bishops who were deposed during the reign of Edward VI and even in Henry VIII's reign. In 1554, she declared that England had officially returned to obedience to the Pope. The Anglican or the Church of England now answered to the Pope again, she declared. Feast days of the saints were restored. Married clergy were ordered to set aside their wives. An open persecution of Protestant leaders became official policy in England. More than 300 leaders of the Protestant movement in England were burned at the stake during her short reign. In fact, another gentleman by the name of John Fox had started early in the 16th century writing a book called Fox's Book of Martyrs. And when this persecution broke out, He redid the book to be a dedication to all of the martyrs who were dying under Mary Tudor. This is my copy of Fox's Book of Martyrs, published in 1850. This book is 171 years old, and this is a 1850 edition of that book, which I keep proudly on my shelf. It was a gift given to me by another minister who's now gone on to be with the Lord. Thomas Cranmer, the Archbishop of Canterbury, remember, he's the guy that invented the Book of Prayer and also the English translation of Scripture, was condemned as a heretic. And after he was condemned, he was burned in effigy. He was not actually burned, but an image of him was burned. Later, he recanted his view of his position as a Protestant, and specifically the role of Mary over the head of the church. He recanted that position, which appeared to be a moral victory for the Queen over Protestants. However, he was still found guilty and withdrew his words of recantation, and his death heartened the Protestants, forcing Mary to take even harsher methods to eradicate Protestantism in England. The sheer number of Protestant leaders and supporters she had killed during her short reign earned her the nickname Bloody Mary. That's why she's known as that, because she attacked the Reformation with gusto in the attempt to return England to its Catholic roots. But the Lord, in his mercy, allowed her to reign only 5 years. Again, as Colin so eloquently put it, there are no coincidences, which led to the rise of Elizabeth I. She came to the throne in 15. She was born in 1533, died in 1603, came to the throne then at the age of 20, at the age of 25, in 1558. She was the daughter of Henry VIII with Anne Boleyn. Charles V, Mary's cousin, had often suggested that Bloody Mary execute her half-sister. And she wanted to do that, never got around to actually doing it, however, which caused then Elizabeth to rise to the throne. Elizabeth, under Anne Boleyn, was a Protestant. And so she began the long process of undoing Bloody Mary's policies. She believed that her father, Henry VIII, had done right in proclaiming himself head of the Church of England. This over against the papal declaration that the marriage of Henry VIII to Catherine was invalid, making her illegitimate to an illegal second wife. Because, again, this is a girl who was born to the mistress, theoretically, the second wife of Henry VIII, right? Which is only valid if the first marriage is invalidated. Okay? See how this all works? So Mary said, I'm not illegitimate. My dad's marriage was perfectly valid. This one comes along and says, no, I'm the daughter of the second wife, therefore the marriage must be invalid. See how this all works together? Next time you watch the documentaries on Henry VIII, you'll be thinking about, what about Reformation stuff? Yeah, this is all about Reformation stuff. Many who had left the kingdom during Mary's persecution began to return, and guess what they were bringing with them? They had fled to the continent in order to escape the persecution, and guess what they were picking up? They were picking up Zwinglian and Calvinistic ideas that were now flourishing in the continent. Remember, this is somewhere between 1558 and 1603, the second half of the 16th century. So they're over there learning these things. Now they can come back because the new monarch on the throne is trying to reestablish the Church of England as a Reformed church, or allow for Reformed ideas. Now, she was not a Protestant extremist. She desired a church whose practices were simply uniform. She wanted to unite the kingdom under a common worship, but with latitude for varying opinions. There was a new edition of the Church of Common Prayer that came out with a third view of this idea of the supper. I gave you the two quotes earlier. Now she just took them both and sort of combined them together to kind of create a middle ground between the two. And by the way, that's where the Anglican Church stayed until even modern times. She was accommodating both Lutheran and Zwinglian views in it. In 1562, the 39 Articles of the Church of England were established as its doctrinal foundation. So the equivalent of the 39 Articles would be the Westminster Confession of the Presbyterian Church or the Second Baptist Confession of the Baptist Church. Okay, both, by the way, coming out of England. We'll see that later. The 39 Articles are simply the definition of the doctrinal position of the Anglican Church. They have been modified slightly since those days, but they're pretty much in place from 1562. And they're designed to try to find a somewhat centrist position. We call it a via media. How do I get between this extreme and this extreme in terms of what we believe? So let's kind of be in the middle, which very much explains why the Anglican Church can't take a stand on anything, even to today, because it's designed to be sort of a middling thing. Lukewarm coffee, in other words. Not worth a thing.
At best.
There were a number of attempts by Catholics during this period of time to regain control through conspiracies against Elizabeth. She had a number of assassination attempts against her. As a result, many Catholics were executed during this particular period of time, including her cousin, Mary Stuart of Scotland, who had attempted a coup against her. In fact, what's ironic here is that the total number of people who were executed during the reign of Elizabeth pretty much equaled that of her predecessor, Bloody Mary. The difference, however, is that Elizabeth's reign was 10 times longer. So 5 years versus 50 years is a big deal in terms of, okay, we kill 300 people in 5 years, it's a whole lot different than killing 300 people in 50 years. And it was during her reign that the Puritans begin to rise in England, inspired by these Calvinistic ideas that are coming across from the continent. Remember, the Puritans were those who insisted on the need to restore the pure practices and doctrines of the New Testament. If you're going to be reformed, let's be reformed. And the Puritan movement would be, I would think, the Zwinglian movement in Lutheranism, and probably the Anabaptist movement over against the Calvinistic movement under Calvin. The Puritan movement would be the movement in England to move the church to total reformation. But that is going to come up later historically. So what we'll do is we'll look at a later reformation in England under the Puritans in our next lesson, which will also describe the creation, the establishment of the Presbyterians, the Baptists, and the Congregationalists in England as the three main branches of the Reformed Church there. But that will be next time. Questions? See, what I tried to do is give you a bit of British history, but from an entirely Reformation perspective rather than from a Romantic perspective. Because nobody wants to make a movie about the Reformation in England. Anyway, they make a movie about Henry VIII and his 18 wives, right?